Hi, I'm Katie Whelan, and join me each week as I talk with experts around the globe about circular economy. You'll find out what's being done to make it a reality, and if it can really solve the problems it promises. It's time for Getting in the Loop. Hi there, welcome back to the Getting in the Loop podcast. I want to start off this episode by saying thank you to everyone who went on LinkedIn and joined in on the conversation over there after the last episode. We had a great discussion going about coronavirus and what this could mean for circular economy. So if you want to take a look at this conversation and even join in on the conversation, I've left a link to this article on LinkedIn that I'm talking about, and I've left a link to this in the description of this episode. So wherever you're listening to this episode, if you go into the description of this episode, you'll be able to find a link to the LinkedIn article and head over there to join the conversation. Okay, so today's episode is going to be a little short and sweet because it is a celebration. We are celebrating 1 year of the Getting in the Loop podcast. That is very exciting, 1 year. And I wanted to commemorate this milestone with all of you and have you all join in on the celebration. So I wanted to start off by saying thank you to everyone who has made this podcast possible over the past year. And a big thank you goes, first of all, to you. Thank you for tuning in, for leaving reviews, for sending emails, for asking questions, for suggesting interview guests, and for sharing the podcast in your networks so that other people can also find out about Getting in the Loop. Over the past year, you and I have been learning a lot about circular economy. We've listened to experts talk about a whole range of things, from designing emotionally durable products and financial indicators to plastic-free certifications and circular business models. So we've covered a lot of ground. And by now, you and I have also realized that there is still so much to be learned about circular economy, right? So the good news is that I have been working on producing many great new episodes that are going to be coming out over the next couple of weeks. So I can't wait for you to hear from these experts and get some different perspectives from around the world and also on different topics. So stay tuned on that front. Okay, so you hear the finished podcast, but you may have also guessed that a lot of work goes into creating each episode. My next thank you is to Alakisti and Monette for helping me behind the scenes. So you may not be aware of them, but it's very likely that they've had a role to play with something that you have listened to or seen online, being it booking guests, uploading posts, or sharing content. And finally, I want to thank the guests who have helped make the Getting in the Loop podcast what it is today. So over the past year, we've heard from over 50 different guests, including those from the US, the Netherlands, Malaysia, the UK, just to name a few. And I think a big recognition for our guests is well-deserved since they have shared their expertise and allowed us to virtually travel the world with them. I wanted to ask you, will you join in with me on thanking our guests? I was trying to think of a way that we could easily all do this, and I came up with an idea. So here it is. First, think about a past interview that you really enjoyed or learned a lot from, and then share a link to that episode on your favorite social media platform, be it LinkedIn, Twitter, even Instagram, wherever you hang out. You could even write why you enjoyed the episode and tag the interviewee, because I know a lot of times I often post the guest's social media profiles at the Getting in the Loop podcast website. So again, share your favorite episode or one of your favorite episodes with your network and try to tag the guest in it. I think it could be a really good and easy way to show some appreciation, and I think it would make the guests a little happy to see these appreciation posts popping up everywhere. Thank you again for tuning in to the Getting in the Loop podcast. I'm so happy that I could celebrate this 1 year milestone with all of you. I want to leave you with a clip from the very first Getting in the Loop podcast episode. So here's a clip with Professor David Peck from TU Delft talking about Britain's resource strategy during World War II and what they did to address supply chain disruptions and material shortages. I think in some ways it's still quite maybe even more relevant today, given the current circumstances that we're all facing in our respective countries.
So what did I find? Well, what I found was due to U-boat campaign in the North Atlantic in particular, Britain suffered a very steep and quick decline in supply of resources, both fossil fuels, energy, oil in particular, and materials from all over the world. And bear in mind, some people go, well, it was a long time ago, so was Britain so globally dependent? Well, actually it was. One, it had always been a global trading nation. And two, it had an empire which it traded extensively with all over the world. So it got very used to trading openly and relying a lot on import as the Second World War came along. So I looked at that, and they were not self-sufficient in any way, and getting towards self-sufficiency in many, many cases was impossible because those resources were just not available in any sensible quantities in Britain. For example, oil. They didn't have oil. They didn't have many other metals as well in any serious quantities, and all sorts of other materials that they needed. So they then developed a range of policies and strategies in order to deal with that. Shall I go through what they were?
Yes, sure. It's super fascinating. I was just thinking with the parallels because I had never actually thought about the fact that they were this global empire. Yes. And they had globalization and they were relying on different materials, kind of like in our current situation, you know, this massive network.
Yeah, empires are controversial, and quite rightly so, and there's still a debate going on about empire. But one thing they were forerunners of globalized economies.
Exactly.
In a totally different way in many ways, but it was there. For a start, what materials are we talking about? Iron, copper, aluminium, nickel, chromium, zinc, and tungsten was very important as well, and that was a challenge. What did they do? Well, they split it into three, and they had actions around product design, which was one of the things I really was interested in. They had actions around production. They had actions around the customers, the users of the materials. And basically, the list's quite interesting because they sort of talked about, oh, use less material, make it lightweight, robust and long-lasting, designed for repair, avoid specialized, you'll use specified materials, but locally sourced where possible. So there's a whole bunch of stuff which, for a start, sounds very modern. But then there are other things which weren't. So you will be told what the design is. So only one designer will specify the design, which for product designers sounds a nightmare. And no ornamentation or decoration. So nothing fancy that's using materials. In terms of production, the government took over complete control. And this was termed at the time socialist design, so you can see why. Production location was specified, the materials were allocated, not just the type of materials, but the quantity of materials they would supply to you. You need a license to operate. Your labor was allocated, so you didn't even hire on the open market. You were told who you will get, and actually they were sent to you. You didn't even hire, they were sent to you. Energy supply was constrained and controlled. This is how much energy you will have, normally often coal, of course. And the volumes and timings were given to you, and prices were fixed as well. And then for the customers, you couldn't get furniture. I focused on furniture quite a bit. You couldn't get furniture that you wanted. You got furniture that you needed. In other words, if you were bombed out or you got married or you were having a baby, then you could have a reason why you needed some particular items of furniture. Well, you had to go through a right performance in order to get some furniture. So for a start, you had to go to your local municipality and fill out some forms. And somebody could come and check. So they might come around your house and check. And you fill out the forms. And then you had to, you applied in those forms to get coupons. Then when you got your coupons, you would go to a store, but the store didn't bother having anything on display. It just had a catalogue, and they would just tell you what they had anyway. So even in the catalogue, you might say, well, I like that one. They go, no, I haven't got that, got this. So you'll have that one. Yeah, but the prices were fixed, and they were fixed quite low, and the quality of the product was super good. And so they were built to last. They were often used. I was surprised because when I started, I thought it was all soft wood and cheap wood and veneers and stuff. And it wasn't. It was a lot of it was hardwood and really robust and well made, because the view was that we have to make stuff to last for a long time. What I then looked through the data, it's wonderful because it's all, it was all secret, but it's all available openly online because it's so long ago. So you'll see all these secret cabinet minutes and stuff like this. But what they did was they were able to cope with more than 50% less, in some cases 60, 70% less material, less energy.
Some of these strategies sound familiar to those that we keep talking about in terms of circular economy, you know, use less material, design for reuse.
Yeah. Yeah, that was something I did in my PhD. I sort of put the circular economy strategies down one column and then these strategies down the other. And you can't put them next to each other. You're so distant in time and situation. But in terms of looking at them, it really struck me like, my goodness, this is what we're talking about a lot of the time. So that really got me thinking. But that I show it as a case and say, this is what they did. So if we're sitting, and as we are, Dutch government policy says by 2030, we will halve primary material use, we will halve energy use, we will halve our CO2 in order to meet our 2050 climate goals. I'm saying, okay, well, I can show you how in the case of the Second World War, they did all this in about 6 years.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. For show notes and links, go to our website at gettinginthelooppodcast.com. And while you're there, subscribe to our mailing list to have new episodes delivered to your inbox every Monday. See you next week.